You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So welcome, everybody. We have a real treat today. Brian Kernighan, who is a Berkman Fellow and one of the pioneers of the field of computer science, he's in the Department of Computer Science at Princeton University, is going to talk to us about enumeracy. And welcome, Brian.
Okay, thanks, Omar. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate your braving the weather, which seems to be endlessly awful in this part of the world. Let's see, why don't we just get started? The genesis of this talk is that for the last 10 or 11 years, I guess, I've been teaching a course at Princeton, which is called Computers in Our World. And it's basically a course on computing society for a very non-technical audience. Everybody in the class is social sciences or humanities. The reason that people take this course is not that I am a wonderful person, although that's obviously true, but rather that it satisfies a check-off-the-box requirement called quantitative reasoning. And so you can't graduate without getting such a course, and this is deemed to be one of the more, well, let's call it more palatable ways to do that. University has an official definition of what quantitative reasoning is. I don't know what it is. I think of it as, in some sense, being able to do grade school arithmetic in the service of day-to-day life. And increasingly over the years, I've come to think of my part of this quantitative reasoning is sort of numeric self-defense. If somebody gives you a number, can you actually assess whether that number is plausible or not? Or if you have to come up with a number of your own, can you come up with one that's actually reasonably sensible? So that's my take on quantitative reasoning. And what I'm going to do here for the next, call it 45, 50 minutes, is to kind of give you the numeric self-defense part of this course. As will become crystal clear quite quickly, none of this is rocket science. Quite the contrary, it's pretty trivial, it's pretty obvious. And therefore, no one in this room needs any of this stuff. But I'm going to bet you've got friends and relatives who could profit being a little better able to do this. So absorb the good stuff and pass it on to your less well-off friends. Okay? So with that, let's begin. About 6-7 years ago now, at a time when oil prices were roughly half what they are today, there was an enormous amount of flap because oil prices were high, and there was a suggestion floated, kind of classic economics, increase the supply of oil, the price will come down. And so we could take the 660 billion barrel strategic petroleum reserve and we could dip into that a little bit, and it would knock the prices down. So that was the basic idea in this story in Newsweek. And then there was one other useful fact that said the average vehicle uses 550 gallons per year. So here's an example of quantitative reasoning. Given that, just that, how long will the strategic petroleum reserve last? Okay, that's the quantitative reasoning question. Let's look. You need two things there. You have to know how many vehicles there are because we know how much they're using, but we don't know how many of them there are. And the other thing we don't know is how big's a barrel, because the cars use gallons, but the oil comes in barrels. And so we need some kind of conversion there. Those are the two things we need. Still don't have any fresh information, but what you could do is to say, well, how many vehicles are there? Now, anybody who's driven around here in Cambridge, come through Alewife in the rush hour, knows that there are a lot of cars, and they're all right in front of you, and they're stuck. But passing over that, you could make a plausible estimate that the number of cars in this country is roughly one per person. Okay? I mean, out in suburbia, people often have multiple cars. In the city, probably you don't have nearly that density of cars, but on balance, maybe one per person would be okay, and that would let you factor in trucks and buses and who knows what else that's using gas, okay? So that's about 300 million vehicles, let's call it. I could be off by a factor of two or three, but probably not worse than that. And the other question is, how big is a barrel? Well, if I were to ask a college age group, they probably wouldn't know. Is it bigger than a beer keg? Anybody here ever seen a beer keg? Yeah, right. Because that was a silly question. And everybody's seen 55-gallon drums, you know, they litter construction sites and things like that. So a barrel is going to be somewhere, presumably, in that range. And I don't actually know what it is, but let's just go with that for the moment. Okay, with me so far? I'm going to call it 50 gallons. So now we can do the arithmetic. We got sort of, I'm simplifying the numbers here. I'm going to, 550 becomes 500. It's just easier. So 500 gallons per year and 50 gallons per barrel. That's 10 barrels per year. And there are 300 million cars. Multiply that by 10 barrels per car. That gives us 3 billion barrels a year. Okay? With me so far? It's pretty easy. As I said, it's elementary school arithmetic. The reserve has 660 billion barrels. We're using 3 billion a year. It is going to last over 200 years. Why are we worried about oil?
So I have a question. Did the oil reserve, is that the same thing as gasoline that the cars consume?
It eventually becomes that way when it's refined.
Yeah, but maybe it's...
There's a factor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, I don't know.
But it's not a huge amount that... As you observe, I could be off, the number of vehicles could be wrong, the conversion factor between barrels and so on could be wrong, but it's not wrong by a factor of whatever.
Because cars aren't significant, aren't the hugest part of...
Cars aren't the hugest part, etc. So these are all the possible reasons why this might be true. And if it were true, then why don't we just tell all those nasty people in places like the Middle East or Nigeria or Venezuela or Alaska or whatever, we don't need your damn oil. Go away, we got it wrong. Okay? Right? Everybody here has a suggestion. Let me give you the real answer, which Newsweek actually came up with a little later. The answer is... That's not billion.
That makes a bit of a difference.
It makes a bit of a difference, yeah. It makes a factor of 1,000 difference, and if you do the arithmetic with million instead of billion, you come up with, gee, that's going to last a couple of months. And so it was a truly stupid idea and compounded in this particular case. Okay, and then to clarify one other thing that Joseph or Ryan, one of you mentioned there, a barrel is, an oil barrel is actually 42 gallons and not, as the New York Times said in another factor of 1,000, 42,000 gallons. Because that would be one big, big barrel. Okay? So this confusion of millions and billions in various guises is in fact fairly common. Let me give you just three random instances from papers over the last little bit. I've got hundreds of these things floating around. But you see, dollars, billions, not millions, euros, dollars, millions, billions, trillions, not billions, millions, not billions. It just goes on. What?
Isn't there a problem that billion is not a well-defined term? It has a different meaning here than a few thousand miles away?
Yeah, the observation, I hope I did turn it on, the observation that billion is different perhaps in other parts of the world would factor into that, and you do see that from time to time. None of these are that particular confusion, however. I think the real problem for most people, and I will include myself in this, is that million, billion, and trillion are just words. They don't have any sort of quantitative value. They mean big, and really, really big. So there's an ordering, but not much more than that. And so it's too hard to reason about things that talk about them. So let me give you a hint about one way that you can actually do some reasoning about this. Here's an editorial in the New York Times talking about something that Obama did back in October, and it said the yearly budget deficit is $1.3 billion. So that's a fair chunk of money. Big number. I have no idea what it means, but let me think about how much does that mean for me personally, okay? Right. $1.3 billion, but there are 300 million of us, and let's assume that we each get our proportion, our direct share of that. That's about $4 per person. So the deficit is a big problem, lots of fighting about it in Washington, et cetera. We could solve the deficit really easily. Let me give you two plans for solving the deficit, okay? One plan, we declare, let's say Friday of this week, you don't go to Starbucks or McDonald's, you take the $4 you would have spent and you send it to Washington, deficit cured.
Then not be a Starbucks bailout.
The other thing that we could do, given that we're here at Harvard, is we could ask some recent Harvard dropout, just give a little bit of his money.
Of course, the debt is $15 trillion, so.
Yeah, there's lots of problems. And of course, the problem with this is that it was trillions, not billions. And that means that my share of the deficit, and yours too, is more like $4,000. And although we get to pay our taxes, there's nobody, anybody here is going to voluntarily say, oh, okay, I'll just send $4K to the government to cure the deficit. It's not going to happen, okay? So that's one of the problems. So this is millions, billions, trillions, and so on. Familiar words, but without much numeric significance for most people. The situation gets worse when you talk about the words that show up in computing, because those are less familiar. They're just as ubiquitous. What do you do about them? So this is the kilo, omega, giga, terapeta guys, right? And so you get corrections like this that it's not clear that these corrections actually help. You know, a petaflop is 1,000 trillion, not 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, and a tera is a million million, not a billion billion. Okay. So it's a problem. And if you have problems, and you know, everybody in this room probably at least is familiar with all of the words that are up there at the top, although as they taper off towards peta, they're less and less familiar. I'm going to bet that relatively few are familiar with the next collection, which is Eta Zeta Iota. And I think that's actually where the SI system stops today, but at some point it's going to have to add another meaningless collection of words. So, here's a story. Back last, a year ago, December, ebook readers like the Nook and the Kindle were very popular potential Christmas gifts for a lot of people, and so the major newspapers were running stories about them. And the Wall Street Journal had a story that said the Nook ebook reader, which comes from Barnes & Noble, has 2 gigabytes of memory, and it's enough to hold about 1,500 digital books. Okay? Fact one. The New York Times, the very next day, had a story, sort of loosely related, that said a zettabyte, and they helpfully said it was 10 to the 21st bytes, is equivalent to 100 billion copies of all of the books in the Library of Congress. Okay? Now, I was at that very instant in the process of creating the final exam for my course. Here are two technological things with numbers. It was a gift from God. So I thought about it, and I posed the following question on the exam. How many books are there in the Library of Congress? Because everything you need to compute that is right there on the screen. Okay? So let's go and actually look at that. The Wall Street Journal says that a book is about 2 gigabytes divided by 1.5 times 10, etc. So it's about a megabyte per book. Not an unreasonable number. The New York Times says there are 10 to the 21 bytes in 100 billion copies. So that is 10 to the 21 divided by 10 to the 11th, or it's 10 to the 10 bytes in one copy of all of the books in the Library of Congress. So there are 10,000 books in the Library of Congress. Well, this seemed a tiny tad small to me. I mean, we are sitting here at Harvard. Harvard is named after a guy who donated in 1638 400 books for a library, right? So, you know, the Widener's gotten bigger since those days, I think. So there were two parts to the question on my final exam. The first part was, can you do this arithmetic correctly? And without meaning to disparage any of those kids who are truly wonderful, I really, really enjoy them. Not all of them got it right, sadly, but it's a good exercise. The second half of the question is this number reasonable? And the answer is, well, a modest number of people thought it was pretty reasonable. You know, it seems like about the right number of books for the Library of Congress. and that's sitting at a university whose own library, though not quite as big as Widener, has 6 or 7 million books. So, and it has open stacks, so you can go down and look at them. Anyway, the Library of Congress, my estimate from their webpage or something, is like 140 billion book, or million books, billion, zillions of books there. It's
something like 140 million objects.
29 million books.
29 million books, something like that.
It's a big number.
And I'm sorry, but the book that I have coming out happens to use zettabytes and books as an example of magnitudes. So I happen to, unless I'm sure I did it wrong, but by my terrible calculations, take War, Electronic, take War and Peace, stack them up, And you take the size of War and Peace on a Kindle, you stack them up, and you go back and forth from Pluto 15 times.
You're stacking actually, the Kindles?
No.
Stacking the physical books.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. Yes, it's a big number.
It strikes me that text versus graphics might be part of the problem here.
These are all just words. I mean, Kindle doesn't do graphics very well, if I remember.
Okay,
You can see what the problem is. The problem is that we're surrounded by numbers. Many of them are very big numbers. Many of them relate to things that are not tangible. I mean, very few people here have an intuitive grasp of what a byte really is, and certainly in any physical sense. None of us do. And at the same time, we're relying on computers mostly, calculators in elementary school and then computers later on, to do our arithmetic for us. And that means that we have pretty much, I would say, lost our ability to do arithmetic. We have trouble doing sanity checks on numbers that other people give us to say, hey, wait a minute, does that make sense? And we're hard put to come up with our own numbers to make estimates when we need them. So what I'm doing here is to sort of show you examples to sensitize you to the kinds of things that might show up in your life, and also along the way give some plausible ideas of how you can just sort of cope part-time. And there's a question over there.
I think you're giving journalists too much of the benefit of the doubt.
I know some working journalists, and they deserve the benefit of the doubt. They're good folk, but at the same time, yeah, I can understand. If nothing else, they're under time pressure. Like all of us. And so I'll continue to give them the benefit of the doubt, but perhaps a little less than before. Who knows? Okay. Let's talk about ways that you might actually be able to cope with some of these ugly number situations. Here's one that I find useful. Everybody's familiar with triage, the idea of sort of separating sheep from goats from the ones in the middle in some sense. A sort of form of numeric triage seems to be useful, where you have a number. Is it way too big? Couldn't possibly be that large. Is it way too small? Couldn't possibly be that small. Or is it somewhere in this amorphous gray area in the middle where, maybe it's okay. It's not ridiculous. So numeric triage, I found, is a useful way to think about this, a way to kind of get the students in my class to think about it. So here's an example. We will do numeric triage on this one. This is an old one. Dear Abby, 15 years ago said, Americans receive almost 2 million tons of junk mail daily. So, quick, show of hands. Too high? Too low?
For 96 or for now?
For 96, if you think it makes a difference more. Or just about right?
I got it wrong.
And geez, I would say, this is terrible. Take a note, someone. Very few people here in the physical audience are willing to commit themselves at all.
Too high.
Too high. Okay. Well, we got a few more people. Now that you've had time to think about it.
Probably too low.
Either that or my arms should be better off.
So anyway, you could actually reason about this. Let's reason about it. 2 million tons is 4 billion pounds, right? There are 300 million Americans, a useful touchstone number. There were fewer back then, but it would, if anything, exacerbate this reasoning. So that's about 13 pounds of mail per person per day. Now, I get a boatload of junk mail, but I don't get that much. Right? And you can see that it's ridiculous. Imagine the mailman or the mailwoman trucking along the street carrying my 13 pounds and your 13 pounds and hardly able to move. So this is clearly nonsensical. And the triage helps. And then the reasoning backwards of, here's the answer, does that actually sort of make sense? Another example, each person eats about 60 tons of food in a lifetime. There's still probably a little bit over there if you want to get your up to. Too high? Too low?
Low.
About right?
Low.
About right.
About right.
That's a ton a year. That's three, that's like... 6 pounds a day.
So Tyler's got the right idea. Yeah. Okay. 60 tons in a lifetime. Let's take a very simplified view of life. You're born, you live 60 years, you die. Yeah. Okay. Very simplified view. So that's a ton a year. And so therefore it's somewhat over 5 pounds a day. And depending on what you include as food, like, soda or something like that, then it's plausible. It may be a little high, but it's not ridiculously high like the previous one was. I think the previous one, the units should have been years instead of days. I think this one's plausible. This is obviously for an affluent society where you get that much food. You're not on the hairy edge of survival. My reasoning oversimplifies things because babies don't eat that much. Teenagers probably eat more. And then it sort of, in theory, at least tapers off as you get older, etc. But this is not a bad estimate. Okay? How about this?
Wait, probably 2 hours, 2 hours. Probably a year.
Does that include having having to buy a new monitor when your old one dies.
No, I do have 1,000 computers at home.
So this is clearly nonsense, and I think it's another one of these year versus days. Yeah, year. It could be that, or it could be years versus days. Electricity costs, 15, 20 cents a kilowatt hour these days. And reasoning backwards again, you could say if computers cost this much, people wouldn't be using them in the middle of talks. You wouldn't have them at home. You'd have to turn it off when you went to the bathroom or whatever. I mean, it's not going to happen.
Well, so, and the other one is just your monthly bill isn't.
Yeah, isn't electric bill is $60.
You might month bill might be twice that, but you left your computer on overnight. So
yeah,
couldn't be right.
Can't possibly be right. And in fact, that's a reasonable way to look at it. There's this that you're supposed to, at all times, be using your common sense and arguing from that and plausibility. Does it make sense? This number made no sense whatsoever. How does it accord with your experience? Well, nobody has ever experienced an electric bill like that. And if it were accurate, reasoning backward, what would be the implications? So these are kind of reasonable ways to at least think about that sort of thing. Let's get a couple more of them just because they're kind of amusing. I mean, these are all good stories. There was a story about jet going 850 miles in 10 seconds that showed up in the London Times, what a formerly good paper there. And think about it. So here you are, you got on a plane, you got to go to, I don't know, San Francisco or something. You get on a plane at Logan, you take off, and the pilot says, please fasten your seatbelts, we'll be landing in San Francisco in 30 seconds. Not right. Can't possibly be right. I have no idea what this...
Minutes.
Maybe minutes, but it doesn't then accord with the correct number down there at the bottom of 7,000 miles per hour is 10 times the speed of sound. So I have no idea what happened here. Just...
Well, but that would be 30 minutes to California.
Yeah. Et cetera. Okay, and one more while we're on the notion of speed. For those of you who are not familiar with the geography in northern New Jersey, the Passaic is actually very much like the Charles here. You know, it's a nice, slow, winding river that flows through basically dead flat territory. With one difference, I think if you fell into the Charles, you would live.
You dissolve if you fall in the
Passaic. Yes, the Passaic is pretty grimy. So I am told by outdoors people that river rates are often measured in miles per day as opposed to miles per hour, and I think that's what's happening here. 200 miles a day is then sort of maybe 8 or 9 miles an hour, and five times the normal mile and a half or 2 miles an hour for the Passaic or the Charles seems pretty reasonable. So I think that's what's happening. The thing that's amusing, I took this picture myself on the train, on the bridge that crosses the Passaic going from New York down to Princeton one day. The Newark Star Ledger, I'm sure that whoever wrote this story was in an office overlooking the river, which is right there in Newark. So it's helpful to know things that you can use for better assessments of other people's numbers or for making your own. So here's a collection of things that I find personally kind of useful, like how many people are there in various jurisdictions or whatever, the whole world, big countries, etc. How much do things weigh? What's their volume? Maybe an occasional density number, something like that. Conversions between different systems of units are sometimes helpful. And then because I'm sort of a technology person, I have a collection of little technology numbers, like MP3 music is a megabyte a minute. That's a touchstone I use all the time. I mentioned electricity, how many seconds in a day, et cetera. Grace Hopper, who was obviously a very influential person in computing and here at Harvard for a long time, used to say, that's a nanosecond. Okay, she'd literally hold up, that's a nanosecond, because light goes about a foot in a nanosecond. So that's a way of calibrating. So all of these things are useful touchstones, and they help you in your assessing other people's numbers, in making up numbers of your own when you need them and you would like them to be accurate. I mean, if you just have got to make them up, well, sure, 17th or whatever. One of the reasons I try to do this, in particular, talk about estimation and knowing this kind of thing in the class, is that students in the class that I'm teaching, although they are non-technical, very often wind up in metaphorically Wall Street, various forms of company where they're doing analysis kind of work. And so that means that they get interviewed, and the interview questions often ask something like, well, suppose this situation, what would you estimate some value would be? And I get this feedback regularly. They are asked estimation questions in class. And the one thing you don't want in that kind of situation is to look like a deer in the headlights, like, Hello. So here's an example of an estimation question. This is purportedly a Google interview question. I've talked to friends at Google, most of whom are software engineers, and they say, oh, I never heard that one. But, you know, how many golf balls could you fit in a school bus? Okay. Well, there's a question. How would you go about it? I suspect everybody here would do the same thing as I would. Well, you know, golf balls about this big, call it a cubic inch. And you need a couple of thousand in a cubic foot. How big's a bus? Well, it's about 8 by 8 by, you know, something like that. And you'd come up with maybe 5 million golf balls in there. But the answer is, who cares? But the line of reasoning that says this does not stymie me, I have a plausible way to attack it, is something that will look good in an interview, and in fact is a nice example of the sort of estimation you want to be able to do anyway. So that's a Google example. One of the things I try to do in my class is the same sort of stuff, but I want to put a veneer of technological relevance on it, because this is a course about computing and communications and so on. So I have an analogous question, which says, how many petabytes could you fit in this room? So here's a desk, okay? Everybody's seen these probably, because this came out of a dead iBook or something like that. That's a standard desk. They all look like that in the laptops here. Dave, do you mind opening yours up and just verifying that? Yeah. So the kids in the class, I did not provide on the exam this nice, neat ruler, but this literally had been passed around the class multiple times, so everybody had a chance to fondle it. Those who came to class knew how big the room was, because it was phrased in terms of the room where we held the lectures. So the people who come to class had a leg up on the problem. And so the question is, you know, how big are these? Well, you can figure out how many there are in a cubic foot or whatever, and how big is the room, roughly, and then the rest is, can you do arithmetic, which is, of course, a previously unsolved problem sometimes, but at least that's the way that one could approach it. So it's the same kind of estimation question, but with this veneer of technology. Okay. There's another kind of number that shows up an awful lot. I probably just sensitized to it because I'm looking for these things, but here's an example of a number that of a flavor that shows up very regularly. Okay? Every day, 10,000 Americans turn 50 years old. Okay? And this comes from something called Gambling Magazine, and I don't know how I came by this quotation, because I've never seen Gambling Magazine. I know just enough about numbers that I think it's a bad idea to be playing in a game where you are not good. But the question is, how do you reason about this? How do you know whether this number is way too high, way too low, or maybe somewhere in the broad could-be-right answer? Well, it turns out that there is actually a useful way to reason about these. It's something called Little's Law. It's a conservation law. It relates the number of things that are in some kind of process to how fast they are arriving or leaving and how long it takes them to process. The classic example is, how many undergrads are there at your favorite school? And then you divide that by 4, which is the processing time. It tells you how many are in the entering class or the leaving class, right? Or one that's more germane to, let's say, this audience in general, there are 300 million Americans. So think of yourselves as in process, okay? Let's suppose life expectancy has increased 15 years in the last 10 minutes. So you're born, you live to 75, you die, okay, slightly. Simplified view of things, that's the service time. Okay, and then the arrival time or the departure rate is 4 million, because you're dividing 300 million by 75. Now this is, of course, assuming steady state. It's ignoring things like increasing longevity or immigration or emigration or anything else, but it's an approximation to what's going on, and it's pretty reasonable. So what that says is that 4 million people reach any milestone in a year, and therefore somewhat over 10,000 reach any given milestone in a given day. And that means that that number of 10,000 Americans turning 50 today is not a bad guess. It's maybe a little low, but it's pretty good. And in fact, here are 4 essentially equivalent things. Every week, 88,500 turn 59 and a half, from Newsweek. 350,000 turn 50 every month, right? And 4 million students graduate from high school each year. So those are all essentially the same thing, all based on that same number of approximately 10,000 a day, or however you want to reason it. Little's Law gives you the approach to all of them. And this actually has something else that's very important. This is consistency, because those are 4 very different things, presumably computed from 4 very different, you know, lines of reasoning, that all come up with essentially the same answer. So that's a good sign. if they came up with wildly different answers, or if there was one that was way off, then you might wonder whether it was right or not. But consistency of independently computed things is often a very good sign, and certainly not a negative. Okay, and speaking of signs, let me just show you some other things that I want to kind of touch on very quickly. I'm not going to take very much time on any of them. But things like what's on the list, which I will not read for you, but give an example or two of each one, just because they're very common. So I want to start with another New Jersey thing. Those of you, how many people here from New Jersey, just out of curiosity? Nobody. Oh, just one. Amara. You correct me if I'm wrong, man. But Amara will actually verify this. Bears are an enormous problem in New Jersey. There are bears everywhere. You can hardly go out of your house that without running into bears. You have to be very careful. You can't send small children to school alone because they might get picked up by bears. There's a bear hunt every year. And that one I'm not making up, where they go down the main streets of big cities and small towns in New Jersey shooting bears on sight. Well, I'm overstating slightly, but it means that there are bear stories in the paper fairly regularly. And so here's another one from the Star Ledger a while ago, observing something about the, you know, travels of bears. And it says young males roam 60 to 100 square miles looking for food and mates. Okay, typical what guys do, right? And then the females, the working class, stay close to the cave, and they're only going in 10-mile radius. They're presumably home looking after the kids. And so the comparison, and this is one of these dimensional issues, is that those are apples and oranges in terms of dimensionality, right? Because a 10-mile radius gives the lady bear over 300 square miles to roam. Okay, so whoever wrote this story or whoever proofread it, and maybe I should, maybe you're right, I should be careful to not say too many good things about journalists, didn't spot the fact that one is square miles and the other is just miles.
They're just not very numerous. Are you sure it's not the same reporter at the New York Star Ledger?
So I pass.
Editor, correcting all the things that the reporter's writes.
I think part of the trouble is, and maybe it's just, I don't know where this happens in other languages, English is a little screwy in this because you talk about square miles and mile square, and those sort of sound the same, but they're very different in what they are. And so perhaps that's a place where some kind of confusion could arise, but there's no excuse for this. I mentioned oddly precise numbers. Here's a lovely example. The caption says, when a yacht is over 328 feet, it's so big that you lose the intimacy. Now, I don't know about you folks, but I move in a different circle. I have never been on a yacht, let alone one that's over 328 feet, so I can't comment on the intimacy. Although I guess I could imagine somebody extremely wealthy saying, well, you know, when my yacht was smaller, it was just so nice, you could get to know everybody really quickly. But now that it's over 328 feet, you see, there's people you hardly ever even see. Or whatever. Where did this come from?
Describing a particular yacht.
A conversion.
100 meters. A catalog where there was a yacht that was 329 feet and another one that was 200.
Cruise liner and
Rob. Tyler and Rob got the right answer. It's a conversion, right? It's 100 meters.
Oh.
So here we are somewhere and somebody says, how big's your yacht? And he says, oh, it's about 100 meters. Okay. And then the editor of the yacht report, presumably writing for an audience here in the United States, which only uses the English system and where the metric system is kind of a foreign concept, says, well, geez, I got to convert that because nobody will know what it means. I'm not even sure myself. So let me get the calculator out. 100 meters, whoops, 328 feet, and in it goes. And you see this kind of thing all the time.
What Next should time... be the policy here?
Could be.
No, but I was saying, what should they have done?
I think probably what they ought to have done is say in parentheses 100 meters, or say 100 meters in parentheses 328 feet, and then you might actually be educating the populace.
Yeah. Well, you're not suggesting they say 300 feet.
Yeah, they could have done that.
In high school chemistry, I learned about significant digits, right? And so you would have one significant digit here, right?
And the significant digit argument is in fact part of it. Because when you do this, you get this specious precision. There's more significant digits than there really are. And you see that all the time. Think about the number of times you see about a drug bust and somebody says that the sniffing dogs found 22 pounds of heroin, right? Same thing. That's 10 kilos. Now, how much heroin was there? Well, there was about 10 kilos.
22 pounds, or even 22.4 pounds.
Oh. So one has to be careful of those kinds of things.
Question.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, in the back.
Sir. While we're on the subject of conversion, I remember when I came back from Japan, my head was all messed with in terms of the value of things. You know, it went from $1,000 or 1,000 yen coffee to a $1 coffee, for example. And so I'm wondering if you've seen anything in the conversion of large numbers to small numbers, which actually have the same purchasing power. Any cultural differences or psychological differences in how we understand what we get for a certain magnitude?
That's an interesting question. I have not done that. I have experienced somewhat the same thing from my brief time in Japan as well, where in effect you had to scale everything by a factor of big, like either 100 or 1,000 to bring it back into range, and that was sort of awkward. Does that make any overall systematic difference? I don't know. I'm just not close enough to it. Absolutely no hardcore data. I would have to ask somebody who lived in some other part of the world where the numbers were like that. Good question. Interesting. Okay, I'm going to shift gears very slightly to talk about things that are more statistical in nature, a little bit. Not so much statistics, but presentation of numbers, which is part of the issue of innumeracy and so on. There's an absolutely wonderful book. I assume everybody here has at one point or another run into this absolutely fantastic book by Daryl Huff, which was published in 53 or 54, I think. And if you take away nothing else from this talk, take away 54, Daryl Huff, How to Lie with Statistics, absolutely wonderful book. And Huff has a lot of different things in there of what to watch out for in when you see numbers in the press. Things like the difference between the mean or average and the median, something we were talking about earlier, that sort of thing. And also some presentation issues. And I want to talk about a couple of presentation things of the form of a kind that Huff was very familiar with and talked about, and then a couple of other things where modern technologies made it easier to do statistical or graphical chicanery that would have been harder to do in Huff's time when you had to do things by hand. One of the things that Huff inveighs against is something called the gee-whiz graph. So here's an example of a gee-whiz graph. Okay, this is the stock market crash of what, May or something last year. And you can see the stock prices went damn near to zero there in a very short period of time. Right? Oh, terrifying, terrifying. Except if you look at it very carefully, you can see that the drop, although it was fairly nice, fairly big, the scale, for example, the curve on the upper right, which came from the front page of the New York Times the next day, goes from about 10,800 down to 9,800. So it's a large part of the graph has just disappeared. It never got printed. The one on the lower left is from Yahoo's homepage, and it's the same sort of thing. A graph goes from 9,900 up to 10,900. So they've thrown away approximately 90% of the range of the data, and therefore the visual effect is overstated by a factor of, let's call it 10 or something. If you plot it more carefully, you see something like that. So this is still a pretty terrifying dip, but it is nothing like the catastrophe that it was made out to be by those presentations, those gee-whiz graphs. So Huff's got a lot of those. Stock market things seem to be a very popular place for that because they're trying to show that there was a change in some stock price, so they throw away everything. And so it went from 100 to 101. Wow, that was a big change. Whereas, in fact, it's a tiny change.
Probably if you print that, especially scaled down with a bit on a page,
it's not appealing.
It's not going to look very good, and you're going to lose most of the resolution.
Yep.
And there is a convention in graphic presentation to show the discontinuity.
Which I, yes.
But it's missing from the examples you showed.
That's right.
A good newspaper would show the discontinuity.
Yeah, so Tom's point is important there. There is sometimes that little squiggle that says, we are lying to you.
Yeah. Because, be alert.
Be alert that we're lying to you because it shows zero, and then there's a little squiggle that you might miss, and then the values start off right there. So that's better, but not good, I think. But then the observation that you can't
print that.
You can't print that.
There's only so much newsprint.
Yeah.
And so let's get the news that prints, and Dave's going to check.
Well, no, for a while, the Globe would print little, for when they do it, an individual stock, they would print the stock and they wouldn't label the vertical axes.
Oh,
so, and it would look really like a terrible drop, but I think they seem to have fixed that.
Yeah. The Times the New York Times actually used to do that same sort of thing,
yeah,
and they would have
graphs used to have no
not at all. Now they just trimmed it off. The New York Times used to put them in with wildly disparate scales, where they trimmed away the bottom, and then they ran a little essay once about how this was bad statistical practice, but it was a bad statistical practice that other people did. It had nothing to do with what they did, and then they stopped doing what they did. So. Another thing that Huff talks about is something called the one-dimensional graph. So here's a one-dimensional graph. We mentioned Starbucks earlier. This is the growth of Starbucks stores from 1987, when I presume the company was founded, until 2003. Okay? And if you look at it, it's clear that Starbucks had an astonishing growth there in the last 3 or 4 years, right? It's just huge. And the reason that it looks huge visually is because what's being plotted there is not the datum. The datum is the height, which is the number of stores, but they're giving you a visual thing that gives you the volume, which is in some way proportional to the cube of something. And so you get this totally misguided view of what the data is. The visual impact says, oh, big, whereas in fact the datum is more like that. Okay, so Starbucks was doing well in that interval, but nothing like as well as the first image would show. So this is, the first one is kind of an artist's conception, and the second one is actual useful data, at least as produced by Excel. One of my all-time favorite examples of this, at Princeton, the graduate school 1 year increased summer stipends for grad students from $500,000 to $2 million total, not individual. And they plotted this just to show how wonderful they had been, how well they had been treating their graduate students. So the height of the tiger is the datum. But you can see that because it went up by a
factor, it, right.
It's cubed it. So this honking big tiger on the right is 64 times the volume of the tiger on the left, which is just absolutely ludicrous. So a great example. One more sort of how to lie with statistics thing, and this is something that Huff never talked about, I think because the computations involved in it would have been just more trouble than they were worth. But every year, U.S. News puts out a very popular issue towards the end of August in which they rank university programs, particularly undergraduate programs, in a variety of categories. Very, very popular. For good and sufficient reasons, in the, I think, 11 years that I have been at Princeton, Princeton has ranked number one 9 of those years. 1 year, they were ranked number 2 after Harvard. That was a clerical error. And then this year, they were ranked number 2 again after Harvard. And I think that's because I'm on sabbatical here. But anyway. There's an absolutely wonderful paper called Places Rated, which was written by some colleagues of mine at Bell Labs a long time ago, Rick Becker and Lorraine Denby and Alan Wilkes. And what they did was to take this fairly popular book that comes out now, I think, every couple of years called Places Rated. And it takes 300-odd cities, American cities, and ranks them on a variety of things to say, where's the best place in the country to live? Where's the worst place in the country to live? And so what Rick and Lorraine and Alan did was to study the data very carefully and observe that by manipulating the weights, just the weights assigned to various components like climate and average income and whatever, they could move more than half the cities into first place, a similar fraction, I don't remember exactly, into last place, and something like 20 or 25% of the cities could be ranked either first or last, wow, depending on how you weighted these things. So what it means is when you see one of these things, it doesn't mean much. What you're doing is taking flaky data, which is especially true of things like reputation score of universities, and combining them with arbitrary weights, you're coming up with something that probably doesn't mean very much. I mean, it's not that Princeton is a bad place or that Harvard is, et cetera, but you can't read too much into it. In particular, you can't read this, I'm number one and you're number two kind of stuff. It makes no sense whatsoever. Okay. And then a final collection of theme, one theme with several examples. When you get a number, part of the assessment process is who's giving it to you. Where did that number come from? Why are they telling you this number? What do they want you to believe? What axe are they grinding? And there's lots of examples of this. Here's one. This is a full-page advertisement at the back of the New York Times one day a few years ago. 4,000 teens will try their first cigarette today. Now, remember Little's Law? How many, let's suppose for the sake of argument,
I'd be willing to bet that everybody in this room at some point probably did this. Suppose you tried your first cigarette on your 13th birthday, just to make it consistent, okay? So how many kids have their 13th birthday today?
4,000.
Got him. Watch that book, Dave. Yeah, so it's sort of around 10, 12,000, something like that, okay? And suppose that a third of them tried their cigarette on that day, okay? It's not inconsistent with the number of people who wind up smoking in the population, which is 20-25% these days. So that's plausible. And this statistic, this full-page advertisement, was endorsed by a lot of fairly heavyweight groups that, although they are advocacy in some sense, they're, I will call them, on, you know, fairly reasonable, and there's a lot of them, okay? 2 weeks before this, there was a full-page advertisement on the New York Times that said, every day, 5,000 teenagers try pot for the first time. Now, I'm two generations past today's teenagers, and therefore I can't assess this. When I was a kid, pot had not been invented. So, so there was no issue of inhaling. I mean, but you can apply the same line of reasoning to it. But this one is harder. And so I've been sampling college age audiences, and some of you are not that far out of this. Is this an accurate assessment? Let's suppose that you try pot on your 16th birthday just to make up something. Is this an accurate, plausible number? Show of hands, yes?
Everybody tries on the 16th birthday?
If you're going to do it on your 16th birthday, yeah. Because that normalizes the group. You might do it a year later or a year earlier, but okay. So the answer I've gotten from college audiences is, yeah, this is probably pretty reasonable. Okay. But the thing that's interesting and germane to the talk here is that this advertisement was sponsored by a single advocacy group, a single issue advocacy group, the Coalition for a Drug-Free America. Absolutely fine, upstanding, important issue that they deal with, but their job is to make their issue sound big and important, and the bigger the number, and perhaps the more precise the number, the more important their issue, and therefore the more you should be encouraged to support them. So one has to be a little cautious of such things. Okay? How about this?
No, too high.
Yeah, way too high. This is actually real. I mean, it show up in this book by Naomi Wolf. It's sufficiently weird, a number so implausibly large, that I dug down into the bowels of the library at Princeton and found the book, which is why the reference is so precise. And it was a misquote that has been propagated, and you can still find lots and lots and lots and lots of websites today that quote this gospel truth. And yet it can't possibly be true. Remember Little's Law? How many American women die this year? Well, there are 4 million Americans who die. Half of them will be women, so that's 2 million women die this year. Almost 10% die of anorexia. In an epidemic of obesity, not a prayer. Okay? So, still there, still uncorrected in a lot of websites. Corrected in lots more, fortunately. Okay. This is something where I don't know. Anorexia and bulimia are a serious problem for young women. Roughly, you know, call it late teens, early 20s or something like that. Serious, serious problem. But the number of fatalities is very small. Tens to conceivably hundreds. Statistics are uncertain, but it's a tiny, tiny, tiny. I think this is the number of women who suffer from this in the demographic of, call it roughly 15 to 30s, something like that. I'm not sure of those facts.
It's a whole constellation of related things, suicide, heart attack. So attributing it to anorexia, there's a question, what do you attribute it to? Oh, you have the figure there.
Answers.com is...
Yeah, if you ask Google how many women die each year of anorexia, the first answer is 150,000 women.
Yeah. Answer.
I have a question. I always go 30,000 people die every year of car accidents. I think that's about the number. People who die in car accidents. I don't know anyone who's died of anorexia. I kind of do that.
Yeah, that's a useful touchstone. That bears on what's the personal experience of this kind of thing as well. How does it relate to your own experience? And yeah, it's exactly the same thing. I think I don't know anyone who died of anorexia. In fact, I only know probably one or two young women who have suffered from it in an obvious way. So, okay, one last one. There's another book that I have here called Damned Lies and Statistics by Joel Best. Kind of a nice book. In it, he quotes this story, which I then tracked down for real.
Oh, yeah, right.
No.
Right. So I'm fond of this one because it does talk about, you know, exponentials and how quickly they grow. It's just ludicrous. Best calls it the worst social science statistic ever published. Now, some of you are social scientists. I don't know the norms of your field. Perhaps you could tell me whether it's tough competition or whether, et cetera. But that's his comment on it. Okay. Anyway, how do you defend yourself against this sort of thing? Well, one is to recognize the enemy, which is everywhere. And we've seen a variety of different instances of this as we've gone along. This one about the source, I think, is very important in some cases, and it's certainly political discourse of one sort or another, but lots and lots of other things as well. Somebody's trying to convince you of something, and they use numbers to do that, which show up in all kinds of ways. It's helpful if you know something you can use to fight back. And so the more things that you know that have some quantitative value, the more you can bring those into service in sort of, no, that doesn't make sense. And so some of that is knowing facts, and some of that is knowing how to do arithmetic. Even very, 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 very sloppy arithmetic is plenty good enough for disabusing something of a factor of 1,000, let's say. I mentioned Little's Law. Rule of 72 is one of these compounding things, which we can get to some other time. And then finally, use your common sense and experience. Okay, as you said, that, you know, you don't know anyone who's ever died of anorexia. It's probably not as common as car accidents. That sort of thing. So what I would like you to do is, of course, to go off and do better in your own lives. Well, all of you know what's going on, so you don't have to change your own style, but tell your friends that they could improve theirs, or your family, or whatever. And if you get some good examples, for heaven's sake, send them to me so that I can have new material for the next talk. In the meantime, I've mentioned some of the good reading. Joel Best has practically an industry of these books. There's a third book there whose title didn't fit. John Allen Paulos wrote a book almost 20 years ago, I guess, maybe even more now, called Innumeracy. He did not coin the word, but he captures the phrase in that word, the whole idea, good stuff. And a fairly new one, this thing called Proofiness, which just showed up by Charles Seif. Proofiness is a riff on truthiness, of course, and it has some of the same style, but for numeric things. Those are all well worth reading. And I think at that point, I will now stop and thank you all for your participation. question, sir.
One suggestion and one question. The suggestion is, do you know the Verizon math thing? This is one of the most incredible examples. Everybody should look it up. It's this guy fighting with Verizon over an advertisement of 0.002 cents per kilobit.
Oh, yes, I did read that. Yes, yes.
And the recording is just brilliant to listen to. You feel so sorry for the guy. That's one thing. The other thing is, there are a couple of blogs that I follow, Graphic Sociology, Information is Beautiful, that sort of say that visual means are the ways to convey a sense of scale rather than just words or even, you know, scientific notation. And so I'm just wondering how you feel about, I know you gave examples of bad graphs, but are good graphs a better tool to use than words such as billions and...
I think that they complement each other is the way I would say it. There are times when you actually need the numbers, but at the same time, well-chosen graphical presentations can definitely convey the insight a lot more quickly. And some people see the visual part much better than they see the numeric part, and I suspect most of it's some combination of those two. I would strongly encourage that. Tufte, for example, has made an entire career of producing books on the visual display of quantitative information, and although I think some of his graphs are overdone, many of them are very, very instructive and clearly much better than the sort of alternative that there might have been before that. I kind of like the combination, but if you're doing it in a hurry, et cetera, depends. It's easier to put down the numbers, and some media do not support graphs very well, and so you kind of get forced back into words. Even trying to use superscripts like to the 21 in a conventional newspaper is not going to happen because they can't do it because their typographical system can't cope. not always and not all newspapers, but I have literally run into that myself. You have to reword it as 10 to the 21st in words, or you have to say 10 and maybe a little caret in 21 on the same line, and that doesn't carry the same thing. I have an example somewhere from the New York Times Magazine that talks about the difference in complexity between checkers and chess, and it says that in a checkers game, the number of moves is 1,021, and in chess, it's 1,050, or something like that. Right? And it's because they flattened the superscripts for the exponents. So, yeah, like, you first.
I have a story to add to your collection, because it's sort of poetic justice, personal story. Well, close to 40 years ago, I gave a serious lecture in Italy. So they couldn't pay me when I finished. So the day I was leaving, they gave me a check in lira. The lira conversion is about 1,000 to 1. Well, it's too late for me to do it, so I brought back to the United States. This was close to 40 years ago. International commerce isn't what it used to be, and I live in a small suburban town. Went to the bank. Bank said, okay, we'll convert it. We will charge you 20%. 20%? That's $200. Well, I had no choice at the time. I said, all right, I deposit the check. Well, the girl or whoever handled the deposit says, well, I deposit $1,000,000. Of course, they found it 2 days later. You get 2 days interest.
That's going to pay for the conversion.
So I wasn't going to tell the bank about it. I'm so disappointed. Justice.
That's great. Yeah, Tom.
Well, I'm just because I spent 30 years as an ink-stained wretch working in newsrooms, I thought perhaps I would add a couple of things to explain why the newspapers make so many mistakes. And the first thing is that most people who are drawn to be newspaper reporters are pretty innumerate people. These are, you know, this gets spread across a curve, and these are people who like words and are not particularly drawn to mathematics first. That, I think, has been changing to the better over time, because I think there's more and more graduate education in newsrooms, and that chances are you have to do some grappling with some math to get a master's degree, at least. The second thing is that as newspapers are crumbling, the amount of energy that goes into copy editing is going down and down and down and down to nearly non-existent. And so a huge number of mistakes that copy editors used to catch, things that get questioned, aren't getting questioned anymore. And I would say it's pretty clear that the Newark Star-Ledger is entirely run out of copy editors. God, that's terrible.
Yeah, the Star-Ledger, which is actually quite a fine paper, is under dire financial pressure at this point.
Oh, the examples you gave go back to 92.
Yeah, so maybe that's not the whole story.
Good point. But when I worked at the Times, which I did for some years, I worked often with the graphics department to create graphics. And we insisted on the discontinuity mark being in the graphs.
Yeah.
And that's fallen away. And I suspect that in when people were doing it by hand, which they were when I worked there, there was more care taken. And I think now the computer does it, you push the button and it's done. I think it's not getting as much care.
I wonder even whether that little mark on the left margin is available in Excel. I remember looking for it once, and I couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And so
I've never looked, but I bet you it's not there, and that could help have a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
This strikes me as one of those topics that people have been kvetching about for decades, if the lie with statistic goes back to the 1950s, and not to beat a defeatist and say we shouldn't even bother, but I wonder if there's any actual evidence, because I've been interested in this in terms of teaching critical thinking skills or teaching skepticism in classes, and it turns out that sometimes there's really no consequent in terms of what people are able to think. And so then that makes me think of comparative analysis. Like, do you know of studies that show in a country where the students have high math scores that they're less susceptible to sort of fuzzy thinking about math in sort of like a commonsensical way? Is there any sense that any of this education is doing anything good, I guess?
So the answer, I do not know. The same answer to the gentleman back there who asked the question. I don't have any of the scholarship that goes behind this, but I suspect you're right that there isn't very much that would say clearly if you did it this way, people will be more able to use numbers in their own defense or whatever than if it's done, say, the way it is in the United States. So that's pure guesswork. That's not based on any kind of study at all.
I have an anecdotal comment on that. I am very interested in what's going on in the conversion on the internet from IPv4 to IPv6, where you go from 32-bit addresses to 128-bit addresses, which is many, many binary orders of magnitude. And there are people on, highly technical people, on the mailing list of the people who run the internet who are arguing that we really, really have to be very careful and very, very efficient in how we allocate these new IPv6 addresses, because we might run out the same way we did with the 32-bit addresses. And they just, no matter how many times you present them with all the mathematics, you get people who, there you go. So why is it that you can't, even these people who are clearly numerate in some sense, they're in technical fields, just don't get this.
I think I know the problem here, which is, I assumed actually until you said otherwise, that V4, well, that's 4 bytes, V6, that's 6 bytes.
But these are people who work with these addresses.
Okay, yeah. I didn't realize that was...
Here's the icon. Your point is so dead on accurate, it's unbelievable. Here's the icon announcement from a few years ago. Trillions more addresses. How many? Well, 79,000 trillion.
I think the reason that happens is like there's a history, at least in pop culture, of saying like what Bill Gates said, 64K will be enough for anyone. But
it's not people not understanding orders of magnitude.
Beat the number of atoms in the universe, you probably won't run out.
I mean, although, as long as you don't have exponential waste.
Well, the problem is the way they were handed out the first part, which is A, B, and C, were huge chunks. So, you know, one could imagine the same concept. You get half of the 79,000 trillion with your A address, and then the other half are left for everybody else. Well, that shouldn't be a problem until you start doing that for everybody. So there's at least conceptually an answer.
I watched the arguments.
I'm just saying that, you know, it always, the IP4 should be enough if we hadn't handed out addresses sort of in a huge block way. I mean,
actually, it shouldn't be enough because there are more people in the world than that.
Although, even
when they started out, conceivable we'd get to that point.
Although with Nat, you know, arguably there could be enough.
Let me get you first and then we'll get back to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to kind of see if we plot this along where we might be going. So we've basically got an increased flood of information total, and where we can expect more of this, in a sense, also sloppy information being thrown at people. And so the question becomes, okay, do people just throw up their hands and give up, or will they start paying a premium for proper numbers or proper information, which is, you know, the big question anyways. But I found it interesting when, in former life, I was working as a journalist in a news magazine that was at national scale in Germany, just rolled out as a competitor to the then main news magazine. And one of their slogans was facts, facts, facts. And one of the things that they did as a sort of a unique selling point was to have an extra, essentially, floor in the building, just full of not copy editors but fact editors. So essentially, you as a journalist would come with your article, walk down there, and have a fact editor descend on you, and you had to show, you know, for word statements that you made, you had to show two sources minimum, if not more, and for figures, you needed to kind of show reputable sources for your figures as well. As well as the kind of common sense checking and cross-checking and so on. So you literally had to kind of stand up before your kind of fact editor for every sort of your particular numbers. And it did lead to significantly less of those kinds of embarrassments, where you then later on had to kind of retract on it, etc. And that was a unique selling point and how they tried to gain market segment. And so I'm just kind of thinking whether that might be part of a fight-back strategy services on the internet that are looking for revenue creation.
I think probably at some point economics will work that way. Now, I suppose the question back is whether the magazine is still in business or not.
Oh, yeah.
Ben?
And they're the second largest in Germany today.
So it's a it is a possible survival mechanism, yeah.
Dave, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah.
Whoever.
I guess one response I've heard to sort of these statistical manipulation things is that
It's, while it's easy to lie with statistics, it's even easier to lie without them by using vague words like significant or many or something like that. I just wondering if you have any comment on that.
I think it's probably true, yeah. This book, Proviness, is good on some of those sorts of things. It talks, for example, about the margin of error that you see in polls, and all the margin of error measures is the size of the poll. It has nothing to do with the content. So it's totally meaningless.
Dave? You know, back when a football field was a football field, and that was, you know, we had standard units of measurement. They were things like the length of the football field, and it was, of course, American focus, but the length of the pile of books that would reach to the moon or eventually to the moon and back. We had the number of books in the Library of Congress, although actually very few people actually know what that number is, aside. But we had these, you know, we had a set of quantities that worked. And I really like the idea of trying to standardize in a totally cliched sort of way, because that's what we need, a set of standards that, for example, when, I don't know who said, you have an IP address for every atom in the universe?
Right.
I didn't realize that was 79 trillion trillion, you know, sort of number. But having that in the citizen's head is one of the benchmarks that actually would be really helpful. So those of us who write, we should be standardizing on a set of cliched measurements until they're parodies of themselves because they work.
Yeah.
Did that include dark matter?
So who's the Wikipedia geek in the room?
Got a question over
so
here.
So it seems to me that in the big picture, we, as a human race, only a tiny, tiny percent of the human race ever even thought about big numbers until the last 20 years or maybe 30 years. Now we have a much bigger percentage, much, much bigger, that is actually publishing. You know, you talk about the writers. I mean, everybody's publishing. It's bizarre. I mean, if you think of it in the big picture. So I think that's kind of an exciting thing that you have these people that normally would never consider or even write about big numbers, you know, are all of a sudden, you know, and we're falling all over ourselves. But I think, you know, that seems to me, you know, to be more of what's happening. Maybe there's an aardvark or wiki kind of check, you know, that you could have. You know, we have 24/7 checkers out there, you know, that gives you the, you know, that would help the number look real.
Mechanical Turk for checking, yes. Molly first.
When numbers get very large, ridiculously large, trillions and trillions, is there more of a breakdown in how people understand them and understand like what they mean?
Oh, geez. Again, there might be, but I don't think so. But I certainly couldn't cite any literature to either support or deny the position. But my sense is most people, they don't. The site that I mentioned called Megapenny is actually kind of interesting because it tries to give you a graphical picture. You know, here's a pile of 10 pennies and then 100 and so on, and it builds things up to, I don't remember what gets the planetary scale or whatever, that shows how these things grow visually. And it's instructive, but at the end of the day, I don't think it helps your intuition that much. I suspect most people just don't have intuition once it gets past something that you can kind of see in the room with you.
Well, just, do you know the film Powers of 10, which they showed
yes,
me?
Yes, yes, yes.
It's available online now, so.
Aha.
Just search for IBM Powers of 10, and it's wonderful.
It's a great
anybody
great
my
movie.
Age has seen it. I don't know about younger, but it basically is a cartoon starting at Lakeshore, Chicago, and going out to the edges of the universe and down to the individual nucleus of the atom.
Oh, it's a great
in 2 seconds per power of 10. It's really wonderful.
It's just astonishing. Yeah, I remember sitting through it dozens of times.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suspect one of the places where people have the most trouble with this because it's such an unfamiliar concept is the log scale of earthquake magnitude.
Yeah.
You know, that, DBs,
you know,
too.
A 6 magnitude earthquake is not, you know, one fifth more than a 5 magnitude. It's, you know.
Right. Yeah. Anecdotally, kids in my class have trouble with logarithms, even though I try to do the simplest possible things. And Dave mentioned dB, which is the same thing with a factor of 10 floating in, just a confusing issue. And so people genuinely have trouble with that.
I was wondering, what you've described here and the class you teach is sort of introductory, right? And you've kind of said a lot of this is like mass media or whatever. So it's maybe not having a huge impact on really important decisions, but I assume the same problem is happening with policymakers, et cetera. So I'm wondering if you have conversations at Princeton about other departments where this should be. What would the advanced class on this be, and who would be taking it? So sort of your, I don't know, is this a plank for some educational policy discussion.
So that's a good question, whether, would there be another class in it? There are analogous classes that do similar sorts of things. The closest one I could think at, look, people take my class to satisfy quantitative reason. That's the only reason. They want to get out of there. Some of those kids are well-connected. I have had, for example, the child of a former presidential candidate in that class, and several kids whose parents are CEOs of Fortune 500 or 100 companies. So they're well-plugged in, but may not be as influential as their parents, let's say, but they might be more so in some other way. So in a sense, it's like spitting in the ocean and hoping to raise the level a bit. Probably you do, but you can't tell exactly how much or how it will work. Is there another course that follows? I would think at that point you're getting into real science or engineering kinds of courses, and so certainly could. There's a really nice course taught at Princeton and other places based on a book by Richard Muller called Physics for Future Presidents, which I've mentioned here at Berkeley before. And that's talking about the same kinds of computations, but focused much more on the kinds of decisions that, say, the president metaphorically or literally gets to decide about things like nuclear power and terrorism and so on. A lot of that is kind of assessing the relative magnitudes of the factors that go into important decisions, like is terrorism more of a problem than something else? What are the facts about global warming, or at least how would you assess them as a non-scientist, and things like that. I think that kind of thing would be a useful course, and there you could imagine a bunch of things like that, one related to computing, which is what I'm doing, one related to, let's call it, physics, energy, all of those sorts of things, another one related to issues in and around molecular biology and genomics, and, you know, life science kinds of things, conceivably another one on psychology. Lots of opportunities. Too many. One more. Let me get the gentleman in the green shirt.
Sure. Although I don't have many specifics to offer in this regard, one of the blogs of the type that Moman mentioned that I look at a lot is called Junk Charts, by a guy named Nathan Yao, I believe, who's an adjunct professor of statistics at NYU, and he selects a lot of graphical representations of data from all sorts of websites and critiques them. He also has a book out. It has a main title. The subtitle is How Numbers Rule Your World. Yes. And his general line of thinking is that as numbers get bigger and bigger, that are tossed around by media producers and political discourse, it's not so much just the number itself that people need to understand, but they need to work through all sorts of percentages and probabilities that media producers use to make sense of these. So he goes through a lot of examples of statistical reasoning people can employ themselves that actually don't make use of any computation or quantitative thinking at all. It can be entirely qualitative, but much more statistical than, you know, the layperson thinks about. So it's another.
Yeah, okay. It sounds familiar, but I've uh-huh. noted it down to go and do that. I think that there are just an enormous number of things here that could be done, and there are a lot of different people talking about it. There's something called the National Numeracy Network, for example. Mm-hmm. They're having a workshop here in Boston sometime next month, I think. Mm-hmm. So lots and lots of places, lots and lots of people think this is an interesting, relevant area to work on, but it's not really cohesive or mm-hmm. coherent, I would say. Anyway, thank you all very much. Thank you.